Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is James C. Zimmering. He is the Thomas W. Tillich Professor of Experimental Pathology at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. And we're talking about his new book, Partial Truths, How Fractions Distort Our Thinking. James, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Now, I want to tell people who are listening, this may sound like a math book, but it's actually a book about psychology and cognition. Correct?
Yeah, it is. And so, you know, it's hard to summarize an entire book in a title, right? But this book uses math as a lens to analyze how humans think, but this is not a math book.
No, and as a matter of fact, it's the kind of math I think everybody should know. I want to say that as soon as I got into this book, I felt strongly that this book should be part of a required course curriculum on critical thinking, and even on the high school level. I mean, I think we should start that early, but it should be part of a course. I mean, it really should, because there's so many important things about the way we live day to day in this book.
That's really kind of you to say. So actually writing this book came out of a critical thinking course that I teach at the graduate level, because these types of problems afflict anyone who's using a human brain, which, you know, is all of us, including scientists and physicians. But thanks for saying so. I think that part of the challenge of being human is you have to analyze how human brains work using a human brain. And yeah, it is central really to all of us as we navigate the world.
As you write in the beginning, I know a lot of people can't grasp this, but humans often fail even simple tasks of reasoning and logic. And worse, we're unaware of the way that we process information and the effects of different factors on these processes. Everybody thinks their thought processes are fine. I'm clear as the sky. I know exactly what I'm doing. I read that and I know what happened. And that's not true.
you know, it's really humbling when you go through these just basic cognitive exercises.
Oh, God.
Yeah, we all do it. And there's books of it. People amuse themselves, you know, with this. And the truth of the matter is that we have these shortcuts that our brains take. They're called heuristics formally, but these rule of thumb algorithms by which we process information, because we have to. If we tried to swallow the world whole, like process all the information that was coming at us
much. We couldn't survive as a species.
No way. But, and so these little shortcuts our brains take get things right most of the time. But under certain circumstances, they get things wrong. Tragically wrong. And it's paying attention to those other circumstances that is really part of the trick in avoiding the disasters that they can lead to.
Well, the weird thing is these heuristics probably developed evolutionarily when we didn't have such an information-heavy civilization. So those same things that helped us out hunting are causing incredible damage in our modern-day age.
Not just hunting, but kind of navigating the world as small groups of nomads, as you said. Yeah, I mean, we are storytelling animals. We get little bits of information from ourselves and our friends or people we talk to. We did not evolve to handle large amounts of population-based statistical data, but this is the world we live in today, right? So we all of us fall back to these reflexes. I could give examples if you want about these little, to show a little heuristic.
Well, let's wait for a minute, because I still want to build up the book.
Oh, well, thanks.
So this book has basically two goals, and this is from your own book. How can we understand the kinds of errors that we make that affect our thinking, perception, and our perception of the external world? But then the corollary to that is, if we're so cognitively flawed, how do we manage to make all the things that we've made in this world, like the phones we're talking about, the board that I'm using and the computers that I'm using to record this? And that is a weird thing to realize, that we're terribly cognitively flawed, but we're able to make all this stuff.
So this is an essential theme that's emerged in cognitive psychology over the past 5 or 6 decades. You know, early on, they started cataloging the errors that humans make, and this led to not just the field of cognitive psychology, but, you know, behavioral economics. And everyone started looking at this and saying, oh, my gosh, we're just these stupid monkeys fumbling about. Isn't this humiliating? And the truth is it's not, because like you said, if you look at humans, we are incredibly talented at solving problems and advancing technologies. Now, we can debate whether we've done things with those advances.
Well, James, I would argue that the people who are doing those things, through the courses they've had to take to be able to arrive at that position to be able to invent those things, they were taught critical thinking. You know, like a physicist, you know, speculating about X, Y, and Z, they've gone through classes of science and logic and other things that have trained them to do this. But for the average person, we're not taught how to think that way.
That's a complicated statement you just made. It's entirely correct. And I have to be careful here because, you know, I am a professional scientist, and so I'm gonna mock myself here. But it is true that part of learning to do science or technology development is basically unlearning or finding tricks to mitigate these problems that we have evolved in that type of thinking. But when you do simulated research experiments with trained scientists and you try to instruct them to act in ways that removes some of these errors we tend to make, forward progress in discovery stops. So
wow.
this really is a double-edged sword. You find people, if you're too skeptical about everything, right? If you're too analytic that any single bit of disconfirming evidence makes you reject the whole thing, you're actually stuck because there's always disconfirming evidence somewhere. This actually feeds into the conspiracy.
That's what I was going to say. Thinking. I was going to say.
Yeah.
Everything you know is wrong.
Well, and everything has to be perfect to be true, right? So this is a horrible thing. There are conspiracy theorists who think that the Newtown shootings didn't happen.
Oh, God.
Right? And what happens is they look at all the information, all the stories that they observe, and then they see one person who behaved a little bit funny, a father who giggled, you know, as a nervous tick or something, and they say, ah-ha-ha-ha, see, that proves the entire
right.
thing is false. And what that basically is you are disconfirming everything based upon a single bit of evidence that doesn't line up. That's actually one of the things that humans naturally do. So the critical thinking skills that you talk about, yes, very essential, but there's a balance. You have to turn things on and off in the right way, and it's tricky.
The conceit of this book, and it's pretty cool, is to use fractions as a tool to point out our errors. And you put that understanding fractions can help us understand ourselves. Now, the average person go, I remember fractions from grade school, and that didn't help me one bit. But, you know, let's lose an example from your book, and it's a really good one. The James Dallas Egbert III 1979 suicide. And he was a player of Dungeons and Dragons. And can go through this and explain where understanding fractions is really critical to understanding that story? And the way it was, more importantly, the way it was reported.
Right. And by the way, before we launch into that, and thanks for that question, I want to clarify, I am not saying that we human brains work with little mathematical calculators inside using fractions to navigate the world. I'm saying that fractions describe the form of how we think and the errors that we tend to make. So James Dallas Egbert, who went by the name Dallas, was this young prodigy who was attending a Michigan State University at 16 years of age, and he disappeared. And he left a note which made it sound like maybe he had committed suicide, but they couldn't be sure, and it was all very confusing. And his parents hired a bunch of private detectives and worked with the local police to try to figure out what had happened to him. And what they learned as they started to talk to his friends is that he was he played Dungeons and Dragons, you know, to huge amount, and was probably his main activity. And at that time, Dungeons and Dragons was a new game. I was 14 around then, and I remember this. It was very confusing to parents because, first of all, it's a game, but there's no board. I mean, they didn't really understand that. It's fantasy role-playing, so you get into these kind of in-your-head scenarios, and it has a demonic component, right?
That's right. And at that time, that was a big deal. There were all sorts of crazy stories about demon possession
huge.
And stuff like that. Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah, well, which regrettably still persists at a baseline level, but then they were really amplified. And so the theories were put forward that he had been... Now, he and his friends played sort of a real-life versions of Dungeons & Dragons in the steam tunnels of the university. And so there was a theory that they were playing the game and something went wrong, like he rolled a critical hit on himself and he committed suicide or someone killed him or whatnot, and that's why he was gone. And the mainstream media jumped onto this and started, you know, publishing headlines, you know, kid missing because he died on a real life fantasy game. And eventually they searched the steam tunnels, they searched everywhere, they went, you know, around the country looking for him. Ultimately they found him about 1,100 miles away in Morgan City, Louisiana. He was a really troubled kid who had basically run away and was just trying to survive. But his sad story notwithstanding, a whole movement grew up around, oh my God, Dungeons and Dragons is this evil, terrible game.
And causes suicide.
Causes suicide and murders, by the way. And there was a reason to be suspicious here, because over the next 5 years or so, there were 28 documented cases of kids who played Dungeons and Dragons and either committed murder or suicide or both. And, you know, this is very meaningful data. This is not something we should ignore. It needs to be investigated. And a lot of people got very concerned about it. In fact, 60 Minutes, you know, which this before the internet, this is one of the major news shows in America, did a piece on it. They brought on the game creators, Gary Gygax. And they really implied in their piece that don't let your kid play these games because it could probably kill them. But what you have to understand is that when you look at 28 murders and suicides, you're just looking at what I would say the top of a fraction. You're looking at the numerator. In order to understand, is this game risky, it's not the number of suicides, it's the rate of suicide, right?
Yeah, it's the percentage.
That's right, a form of a fraction. And
so you need to look at the denominator.
Exactly. So ignoring the denominator, right, is a central theme in the book. It's a big problem. So when they looked at the denominator, what they realized was that by that time, Dungeons & Dragons had become so wildly popular that 3 million kids were playing it. Now, you know, adolescence is a tough time. Suicides and murders,
that's
regrettably,
right,
happen. And the base rate of that at that time was about 120 suicides per every million kids that just happened to be adolescents anyway. So if you take 120 suicides per million kids, 3 million kids are playing, you would predict 360 suicides each year, by the way, in that population. And we're talking about 28 over 5 years. So when you first look at that, you're like, oh my gosh, 28 suicides, that's horrible. But when you consider the denominator, the game was, if anything, protective. And so that is the type of, and by the way, we ignore this now all the time. Playing this forward, you look at you know, kids that are involved in mass shootings, which is this horrible thing.
That's right.
And then everyone notices, oh, they listen to this type of music, or they're playing violent video games, and then everybody starts freaking out about this type of music and violent video games, and we keep doing the same thing over and over again. We should investigate these things, but you have to look at the denominator and take it in context.
And this is the critical thing. Don't just look at the numerator. Look at the denominator and learn how to find the denominator. It's not always easy. And these fractional problems means that we're talking about things like frequencies, rates, percentages, probabilities, all of this. And these are things that start huge debates now. And it's these kinds of statistics are thrown around, especially in politics, a lot. And it's critical to understand what's really, really happening. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Uncle Mark. This is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is James Zingring. He is the Thomas W. Tillich Professor of Experimental Pathology at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. We're talking about his book, his new book, and it's really an important one to read. Partial Truths, How Fractions Distort Our Thinking. So, again, whenever you hear a news story that gives you, you know, this number of things happened, always ask yourself, what's the denominator? How should I try to understand this? The problem is, and you write this in the book, people tend to ignore data-driven news stories. And
well,
I think, is that because they hate math?
No. Well, I can't speak to the extent of people who dislike mathematics, but I think that data driven, I mean statistical information based. We prefer stories. We prefer simple arguments. We don't like, you know, to have to wrestle with nuances. Even trained professionals who are trained to look at data in certain areas prefer simplified anecdotal evidence over the broader statistical evidence. And, you know, I, by the way, me too. You know, I know. Like stories. But you have to drill into it. And as you were saying, it's not just understanding that there is a denominator, which is the first trick, but then understanding, you know, what that denominator is, how it works, right? So as the pandemic was rolling out, there were articles being published that the unemployment rate was dropping and average wages were going up.
Right.
And you're like, wow, hey, that sounds pretty good. What's going on here? Well, the unemployment rate is a fraction. It's the number of unemployed people divided by the total number of people who are seeking jobs. And you have to make it that way, because if you put, you know, infants in the denominator, it would make everything bizarre. And average wage is just that. It's an average of the wages people make. But when the job market gets so bad that jobs start disappearing, that people just give up, they stop looking for them, unemployment drops because the denominator is getting smaller. And what happened in the pandemic is the jobs got so bad that people stopped looking for work. The unemployment rate dropped, and the people who lost their jobs were disproportionately people earning lower income, and therefore the average wage, you know, went up. So you're in this weird situation where if the economy is getting much better and if the economy is getting much worse, the statistics you're seeing have the exact same trend. And that's the kind of nuance that it's really necessary to unpack, because we're peppered. You know, politicians throw stuff at us, and we're peppered with them all the time, single numbers that they manipulate because they can. And we need to be able to just understand the underlying properties.
And that brings up a thing that you talk about in the book is what's very sinister are where people are consciously manipulating the data and the way it's presented. And they're using it for their own advantage.
Yeah.
Like, well, a good example, and you use this in the book, about crime rates among Mexican immigrants. And a lot of people were alarmed by that. But in fact, when you looked at both the numerator and the denominator, it was a very different story.
I mean, this is a classic example. That's right. And again, by the way, we are very good at confusing ourselves. But then on top of that, the disingenuous manipulation by others. So, you know, people have very polarized views on the different political parties right now. And so I'm not trying to pick on one party, but as a point, they all do it. As a point and example, though, in the 2016 presidential campaign, right? So that then candidate Donald Trump referred repeatedly to this poor individual, Catherine Steinle, who was killed by an undocumented immigrant. And they basically just said, look, undocumented immigrants are dangerous. We need to shut down the borders. And again, this is very similar to the James Dallas Egbert looking at a single number, in this case, a single person, right? But a single number. And then you look at, oh, gosh, I heard stories about people being killed by undocumented immigrants. They're really dangerous. But when you just do the simple math and say, all right, of the undocumented immigrants in the United States, how many of them commit violent crimes versus citizens born here? It's unequivocal that citizens born here commit more crimes, more violent crimes than undocumented immigrants, period. In fact, in this case, the numbers are so clear, you couldn't even mess with them if you wanted to, you know, statistically, to try to make them come out the other way. And so, yet you have people with megaphones screaming, look at the cases of people being killed by undocumented immigrants. In particular, Mexico, and you look at Mexico, Mexican immigrants, it's the same thing. So I guess you could argue that the candidates out there, they themselves are also confused. You could argue, I suppose, that they don't know, they think it's true and it's not. But I think that would be hard to argue because they know what the data and the statistics are. And so, yeah, now you may decide for all kinds of other reasons you want to close the border, but don't use as a reason a disingenuous manipulation of something that is factually just incorrect.
There are so many interesting named things in this book. Like, I'm going to give you an example. What is the no true Scotsman fallacy? I just love the name of that. Well, I'm also part Scot too, but I love that. Okay. Because it really illustrates a really important thing.
So I don't want to insult your Scottish
Oh,
heritage. Oh,
please do.
A great story. So basically, the Know Your Scotsman fallacy is based on kind of a comical story where there's a couple Scotsmen sitting in a bar, and one says to the other one, you know, all true Scotsmen can hold their liquor without fail. And so, you know, a guy comes in, he's clearly Scottish, and he takes one drink of alcohol and he falls on the floor unconscious, you know, just feet up in the air. And this guy looks at his friend and says, well, obviously you're wrong, because there's a Scotsman who had one drink and he's unconscious. And his friend looks at him and says, no, I'm not wrong, because he is no true Scotsman. So basically what you're doing is you're saying, I'm going to make a statement. It's basically here it's kind of a fraction. And anything that doesn't fit, I'm going to toss it out. And, you know, this is comical, but it happens all the time.
Well, this brings up confirmation bias. The data that we are paying attention to is the data that confirms already our worldview.
So confirmation bias is probably the worst, most destructive bias humans have, although it is useful in some instances. But you're right, it takes two forms. One is ignoring evidence, like not even acknowledging evidence that disconfirms your beliefs. And the other is kind of diminishing its importance. And so that's exactly what the No True Scotsman fallacy points out. And case in point, if you'll forgive me for using this example, just in case someone were to stand up in front of people and say something really bizarre like, I acknowledge the legitimacy of this election only if I win. Right, just in case someone said something like that, what they're basically saying is, you know, if I don't win the election, it's not legitimate. It is exactly the No True Scotsman fallacy, and you know, a lot of us do this, you know, in our everyday lives, arguing with our kids, whatever. But in this case, it becomes a little bit more dangerous
because it can lead to all sorts of extraneous behavior that's very violent and dangerous in this particular case.
Yeah, it's an absolute and kind of absurd thing, but it makes a certain amount of sense, right? You do this all the time. You make a statement, and if there's something that comes along that contradicts the statement, you just change your definitions a bit so it doesn't fit.
There were many experiments and experimental evidence and research that's quoted in this book. One of the things that I've got to see this to believe it, you were talking about our minds distorting the frequency of things that we encounter. And if we tune in and find something a bit meaningful, we assume that everything else around that is also meaningful. And there were several experiments that you quoted about that, but one of the weirdest ones is Christopher Chabris' Invisible Gorilla.
Mm.
Have you seen that film? I would love to see that.
Well, so unfortunately, I may be spoiling it for you because once you know it,
you'll look for it. Yeah. But talk about it anyway.
Well, so this is an example of humans. You know, we have to focus our attention on certain things, and when we focus on very narrow things, which we do, then we kind of ignore everything else. It's the whole basis for really good stage magic, right? The amazing part of the trick is not that you can't see what's going on. You could see it, you just don't, because your attention is being distracted. So the Invisible Gorilla is this famous video where you have people in different color, two basketball players in different colored jerseys, like, you know, about eight or nine of them, and black and white jerseys, and you're told they're all passing basketballs around. And you're told to count the number of passes that people with black jerseys make to each other and ignore the passes from white jerseys. So, you know, it takes a bit of attention. And if you watch the video and you focus on it, you know, the answer is like, you know, the videos vary, but say the answer is 15 passes. And some people get that right and some people get that wrong. But that's not the point. The point is that the majority of people don't see the actor dressed in a gorilla suit who walks right across the middle of the screen, turns towards you, thumps its chest, and then walks off.
Wow.
The way, it's not a subtle like, oh, let's run in and out and try to fool the people. It is right in your face. And then when you tell people that they didn't see it and show them the video again, quite a lot of them say, no, you doctored the video. That wasn't in there the first time. And so this is basically something that happens to all of us as we focus on things. And actually, its manifestations are dangerous in real life. Arguably, this is the leading cause of motorcycle fatalities, called a look but don't see fatality, because when you're driving a car and you're turning left, you're looking for cars coming towards
that's
you.
Right.
Looking for oncoming
that's right.
traffic, especially at night to headlights, and that's what you're looking for, and nothing else registers. So someone coming on a motorcycle, you'll turn left in front of them, and they'll slam into your car. So there's so much information out there, as we talked about earlier, as your brain filters down on the things you're paying attention to, you pretty much ignore everything else. And that is one of the major ways we just miss stuff.
We even use confirmation bias retroactively. There are revisionist histories, and that's getting to be really popular right now. Why do you think confirmation bias evolved, though, to begin with? It seems like it's an instinctual thing.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm not, you know, there are evolving theories now about the interactionist model of human reasoning. What that means is that human reason didn't evolve for individuals to solve problems. It evolved for groups of humans to reason through problems together. Now, some of that is kind of social dynamics trying to game theory manipulate other humans, but a lot of it is cognitive processes. And so some of these logical problems that individual humans are really bad at, that you alluded to earlier, when you give that to groups of people and allow them to debate them, they solve the problems fairly easily. And then you would say, well, in order for that to happen, though, there has to be debate, argument, exchange of ideas, exchange of information. Confirmation bias is argued to exist because if we didn't have it, we wouldn't stick by our guns long enough to vet out the argument, right? Because as I was mentioning earlier, any idea you have, there's something out there that just doesn't line up with it,
right?
Right. And so if we were like the conspiracy thinking, one little inconsistency, if we rejected every idea the first time we came across any evidence that didn't support it, we would believe nothing. So it's important to have the confirmation bias. Otherwise, we would just be quite confused. The problem is it becomes extreme in some settings, and individuals or groups can't get out of it. But and when I said earlier that in simulated research experiments, if you get rid of certain things, scientists no longer make progress, this is that thing. If you get rid of confirmation bias, and the reason they no longer make progress is even when you have a true theory, even when you have a true belief, you'll come up against some things that don't support it. They may be incorrect facts. They may be just inconsistencies. If you suddenly disbelieved everything the moment you had a single doubt, right? I mean, think about your normal life.
You're not going to make any progress.
No, you'd be a quivering ball of gray matter, right? You're just going to sit there and like look at the world.
We're going to have to end there. We're completely out of time. My returning guest tonight is James C. Zimmering. He is the Thomas W. Tillich Professor of Experimental Pathology at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. And we've been talking about his book. It's an important book, and it's actually an enjoyable book. The scope of the book is wild. It actually goes all the way out into the universe. Partial Truths, How Fractions Distort Our Thinking. James, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me. I love talking to you.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.